Working Cows Podcast, episode 206.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, here with another episode for you guys. Very excited to be joined today by Ryan Noble. Ryan ranches in eastern Colorado, and last time we talked to him, we talked to him about his drought management strategy. And today we're going to talk to him about how he has been using EPDs over the years to inform his decision making as far as breeding decisions and bull purchasing decisions, and try to talk to him about how we can extract some answers from the EPD as we seek to use it as a tool for increasing profit. And Ryan is a longtime Ranching for Profit alumni and executive link member, and that framework is informing how he makes his decisions. And so I think maybe he has a little bit of a different perspective on how to use the EPD to get those helpful answers for our businesses. So Ryan, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Clay. I just got to give you a big shout out and say, wow, 200 episodes. That is so cool. I know. In all my travels here, there, and yonder, and discussions with executive link members and stuff, you're truly making a difference in people's lives, and we appreciate you, and we love your way of presenting subjects to us that really, really makes everybody think. And that's what this whole thing is about, is to create a culture of thinking outside the box and sharing some information and helping each other out. So thank you, Clay.
Well, appreciate that. Any good that I've accomplished, all the glory goes to God in that regard. He's able. I don't know. I don't think this is a direct quote from scripture, but he's able to draw straight lines with crooked sticks. So I appreciate that.
That's cool.
The topic of EPDs and expected progeny differences. Is that like the RBI? It's already plural. You don't need to add an S to the end of the RBI, runs batted in is already plural. Anyways, that's probably another discussion, but.
Right. I don't know if it's a non-count noun or what. Is it a moose or a bunch of moose, or how's that work?
So yeah, I came up with another plural like that the other day. I can't remember what it was right now, but anyways, just kind of frame the discussion for us. What are EPDs? What are they measuring? How can they be used to measure or influence decisions made at the ground level?
Right. So an expected progeny difference, basically in my lifetime, I've watched these things go from non-existent to pretty intricate and complex. It was probably about the late 80s that a few of the breed associations were starting to toy with this deal. And back in those days, it was pretty much birth weight, weaning weight, and yearling weight. So they started trying to get a handle on that. How can we offer a tool out to these cattlemen that will help them make a decision as to what bulls to use? And basically it's a comparison tool to be used between two bulls. So one of the problems people have with EPDs is they just look at the EPD and try to compare it across the breed. Well, that might work, that might not, but from a strictly basic level, you need to look at bull A and bull B and compare their EPDs to one another. That's how it was intended, and that's still how it's supposed to be used. But a lot of people now are looking at, you know, this bull's calving ease directive 10, and the breed average is an 8. That's it sort of works, but that's not particularly how it's intended to work. It's supposed to be from bull A to bull B, a direct comparison of how these bulls measured up with each other. So,
sure. And drilling down a little bit more specifically, first of all, we've talked before, and your episode, previous episode, will be linked in the show notes page at workingcows.net/206. And I think we got into a little bit of the structure of your business because we were talking about drought management and drought planning. But could you just kind of set the framework for your business and how it's structured, what it looks like, so that we can kind of move on from there and talk a little bit about how you've deployed the EPD in your business?
Sure. So I'll just give you a brief history. So my great grandpa homesteaded right here in 1910. He came from South Central Nebraska in the Red Cloud, Nebraska area. But anyhow, so I'm the fourth generation on this place, and my whole life we have been a cow-calf operation. That's what I always wanted to do. My parents were cow-calf people. You know, that was our main goal, was having a cow herd. And we always strive to have a commercial cow herd as we could possibly raise. About 7 years ago, I think I went to ranching for profit. And of course, we all know just the amount of tools that they give you to really dig deep and analyze your business. And, you know, start looking outside the box and, you know, just looking at other possibilities of how to run this business more profitably, because we all have a decent idea that some years are more profitable in the cow business than they are in others. And maybe a guy ought to be changing classifications a little bit of your enterprise mix. But long story short, historical cow-calf operation, the summers of 2018, 19, and 20 pretty much forced our hand into dispersing the cow herd. And now at this point, we run all yearling heifers. We background heifers, develop heifers. So right now I have about 3,000 head of calves on the board above me that we're going to wean this fall. Some of them are custom cattle. Most of them are owned cattle. We're actually going to do some steers this year, some custom, some owned, to put it in our grow yard. But we're just trying to help some people out of the drought north of here and west of here, because we've been in that boat, and we're trying to help them preserve some assets so that they can hopefully manage into next year and hope for a better moisture window. But right now, our main gig is developing replacement heifers for other people or to sell in the fall, or to turn back into cows if the market says that's the direction we need to go. So anyhow, back in the early 90s, I would have been a sophomore, junior in high school. I graduated high school in 1992, and we have a neighbor that's a seed stock producer, and you know, I had the opportunity to go to the National Western Stock Show and help them exhibit their purebred Angus bulls, and I was getting pretty excited about some of the data that I was seeing about expected progeny differences and just how the Angus breed at that time was differentiating from some of the other breeds. And they were really trying to bend the curve. I mean, that's a pretty common statement now, but the first time I heard curve bender, I had to have somebody explain it to me. And I said, "What do you mean a curve bender?" And I said, "Well, you know, you can go out and you can buy growth bulls, or you can go buy heifer bulls. But what we're trying to do is make low birth weight bulls with a lot of growth." And that really intrigued me at that time, because I could see the benefits of, you know, reduced labor of moderate birth weights, cows calving unassisted, but still having a very, very marketable steer calf in the fall, because we'd all just lived through the 80s and the continental invasion, where, you know, probably in the early 80s, 99.9% of all the cows I saw were Angus, Hereford, or Black Baldies, period. And when the Simmentals, the Charlet, you know, the Gelvy, the Limousine, which every one of these cattle brings a lot to the table. But when we first started using those, we were talking extreme birth weights of, you know, 120, 150 pound birth weights out of very moderate cows, 1,050, 1,100 pound cows. It was a big, real problem. You had to be on call 24/7 or you're going to lose a bunch of calves and lose some cows too, because the birth weight deal was very real back in that day. So that's kind of where I got started on the EPD track. And then, I started college and taking animal science classes and stuff in the early 90s. And I just really kind of felt like a strong observer of the EPD progression, if not, a little bit of an advocate, helping some of my older neighbors and definitely my family understand why this was kind of a neat deal and why it was so important and how it was going to help us further down the road. So it's been fun to watch this whole progression from pretty much non-existent to what now I'll throw out there, I believe, is a little bit intimidating and a little bit confusing to somebody that might be trying to get their mind wrapped around it. If you open a bull sale catalog today, there is an absolute plethora of information that is available. And I would think if I was getting into the cattle business or starting to look at some of this information, I would be a little bit taken aback just where to get started and what I was really looking for. So that's kind of a summary.
When I released an episode recently with Hugh Engels of Centennial Angus Ranch here in just south of where I'm sitting right now, and in western South Dakota, he's in that Mud Butte country, Faith and Newell, if you know where those are. But anyways, I went to his female sale. He had basically a complete dispersion of his female herd. And in the front of that, they had a bunch of history on the ranch. And one part of that history was they started measuring kind of the productivity of the herd in the early 80s, I think it was. And I asked him about this, and he said selective culling was how they did it. They started to really put some pressure on these girls. And I want to say they nearly tripled the amount of pounds weaned off the same number of acres over that time period. And so I think that, it was I don't mean this as a pejorative term, but it was a fairly conventional approach to that. And the EPD played a big role in that, in selecting, kind of sire pairing and some of those things. So, could you talk a little bit about, how the EPD can be used in a commercial operation, in kind of the everyday ranch scenario, not necessarily the registered side of the industry?
Sure. So I just got to throw out there right now, and I've talked with some folks at the Angus Association about this, but I think a lot of these numbers are fairly accurate, and I think they're pretty darn useful. But I think they just need to trim some of this stuff down and give us a little bit better, layman type information that's more pertinent to an average cow-calf producer, in the United States or wherever in the world. Because we all understand that there's some things that really economically drive a ranch operation. Obviously birth weight needs to be addressed, but it doesn't have to be extreme. If these calves are the right size that they can be born unassisted, that's small enough. We don't need to chase that rabbit trail to an extreme. There's no reason for a 1,200 pound cow to have a 50 pound calf. It's just not needed in this day and age. I think we've absolutely got a handle on the Cavanese situation. weaning weight and yearling weight are very, very good things to measure for us. But, you know, that side of the production scale also has the balance of what's the input cost side to get us to there. And as we all know, there is a heck of a difference between the middle of Missouri and the middle of South Dakota or Eastern Colorado. You know, what's your feed base? What do you have available for these cows? What's your winter feed program look like? What are your expectations? Because if you're in a brittle environment, you know, maybe the last thing you want is a growthy calf. A live one will fit the ticket, and a growthy one is going to put you out of business. So, you know, these things, there's a lot of things out there. There's just so many variables like we see in agriculture all the time that you just really got to look at them and appreciate them. But you also got to say, now, you know, what's really important to my ranch economically, and what's really driving the profit of my business? Is it the output side or is it the input side? You know, and I also see some of the folks that get kind of carried away. We got two sides of it. We get guys that focus on the input side and don't worry about the output of the beef animal. And that can get you in a little bit of trouble too, you know, because you still got to send this animal on through the food production chain, and they need to grade, they need to yield, they need to gain, and they need to do it in a kind of a timely manner. But also we got the other camp, which is high octane. You know, these cattle need to gain 4.3 pounds a day for the 100 and, you know, for the 14 months that they're on earth. And that's going to get you in big trouble on the female side, because I don't know too many people that can afford to keep a female around that's geared to do that. So my thoughts are, A, we need to really do some introspection as a rancher, figure out, you know, what can my ranch support? What can my lifestyle support? Where do I want to be? And that's where I think these tools can really, really help a guy kind of dial in and say, you know, I'm going to pick this parameter of the cattle that I'm going to select because Mother Nature and my latitude and longitude are telling me this is where I need to be.
Hmm. Yeah, man, I really appreciate that. So where to start? Where when I open up that bull sale catalog and I've done my homework, I know my latitude and longitude tell me this is where I need to be. Where do I start? What are some of the things I should look at? You know, and I know I appreciate that, you know, latitude and longitudinal distinction, because that, I think that really is huge. We're trying to ranch in nature's image, ranch according to what God provides, and not try to be like our neighbors 500 miles to the east or, you know, whatever. And so where do we start? What are some of the things we should look at?
Well, I think we look at this bull sale catalog, and I'm the most familiar with Angus cattle. I mean, that's what we raise. That's what I focus on. And so I apologize to anybody else out there, but I'm just going to use Angus as an example. And I think the first thing we need to do is say, what is our marketing plan on our product? Are we going to sell off the cow? Are we going to background these calves? Are we going to run them over as yearlings? Are we going to send them to the feedlot? Mm. You know, what is the end result that we have in mind? And that's going to start answering a few of your questions there. And then also we need to decide, am I going to source my females from another ranch? Am I going to try to raise my own females? Am I going to buy running age replacement cows? Thank you, Bert Teichert. Great point. What is my game plan for replacing females on this ranch? You know, so if we have a couple of these things in mind, and one more thing I'm going to throw in there, what is my labor situation? Am I a 75-year-old man running 750 head of cows, or am I a 25-year-old guy running a couple hundred cows or 50 head of cows? What do I have a job in town? Is this my only gig? What does my labor look like? So I think we take a look at that. And of course, I'm going to say if we start with the labor, we need to take a look at, you know, the calving ease direct and the birth weight EPDs and say, now, I'm not going to calve any first calf heifers. That goes back to my replacement female side. So I can probably, if I'm only calving mature cows, you know, I can be in that breed average or a little bit above in the Angus side and the calving ease direct, because I'm probably going to not have a lot of dystocia problems. You know, I'm running a 1250 to 1400 pound cow, which a lot of guys do, you know, breed average or a little above is probably not going to be a big deal. These calves are going to lay down and have a calf. If I'm calving a lot of heifers, you know, maybe I need to be at a, and everybody's got their own opinion, but you know, maybe I need to be a plus 8 or a plus 10 for a calving ease direct, or close to a zero or so on a birth weight on an Angus bull. If I got quite a few heifers to calve. And so that might be the place you get started on the labor. And then your marketing plan, are you selling calves off the cow? Are you going to background them? Are you going to send them to the feedlot? Are you going to retain ownership? Are you going to run them clear through and sell them as 9 weights, say, you know, in September of the next year? Because that has a lot to do with just your needs. I mean, you might, if you're going to design your program, you better make it to fit your needs. Cause if you don't, you only have one person to blame, and that's yourself. So I'm going to say probably 90% of everybody in that's going to listen to this probably retain their own females, calve out a few heifers, mostly have mature cows. So they are pretty much looking for just a balanced trait bull. You know, they do a lot of things well, and we're in that camp ourselves. I try to buy bulls that are in the top 25% or better for pretty much every trait I can find. You know, once again, I'll reiterate, there is a lot of traits on an Angus bull anymore. There's, you know, calving ease direct, birth weight, weaning weight, yearling weight, dry matter intake, yearling height, scrotal circumference, docility, claw angle, or claw shape, claw angle. They got a new PAP deal, which has to do with brisket disease for high altitude bulls, heifer pregnancies, calving ease, maternal milk, maternal weight, maternal height, carcass weight, marbling, ribeye, fat. And then they have the dollar index, which is dollar maternal, dollar weaning, dollar feed, dollar grid, dollar beef, and a combined. And to me, that's just pretty darn overwhelming for your average guy. And it's kind of you almost have to have a master's in some sort of numerology to get all this stuff to figure out, you know, get it figured out, because it's just a little bit overwhelming. And it's hard to find bulls that do a nice job in every category. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is what I see a lot is these guys, a lot of people look at something and they say, man, if I can go from a weaning weight EPD of, you know, a 50 to a weaning weight EPD of a 91, somehow that's going to be 40 more pounds of calf. Well, technically, maybe, but in the real world, probably your weaning weight on your calf probably has more to do with your feed resources, the size of the dam, the weather situation, herd health, when you're going to wean him. You know, did you get that one rain in July that really got the warm season grasses to grow in? I mean, there's so many variables there. And maybe the big question is, do I want another 40 pounds of calf? Because a 495-pound steer in this country brings $2.15 a pound right now, and a 550-pound steer brings $1.80. So the worst thing I can do is put that extra 55 pounds of steer on my calf, because it cost me $30 a head.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more powerful tools, and it's outside of the purview of our discussion today, but that value of gain, you know, what am I getting paid to put that extra 50 pounds on? Sometimes you are getting money taken out of your pocket to put that extra 50 pounds on. So That's absolutely that's a big deal. So I just Googled bull sale catalog, came up with a bull sale catalog for a ranch I've never heard of. And I scrolled past all of the five-figure bulls in the front of the catalog down to some of these four-figure bulls in the middle of the catalog and picked one random one. It's got a couple of names I recognize in there in the pedigree, a bunch of names I don't recognize. I have no idea where this bull is at and where anything about him. But here are some of the numbers. Calving ease direct of 3, birth weight of 1.7, weaning weight of 63, yearling weight of 121. What are those numbers telling me?
Okay, so calving ease direct is basically, are these females going to lay down and have a calf? And somebody's probably going to correct me a little bit on this, but more or less, is his lineage easy calvers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, back in the day when I started using my current seed stock provider, who I've been using for over 20 some years, I was having 65 to 75 pound calves out of my old seed stock provider's bulls. And we had to touch a lot of them because they were shaped wrong. It was not a weight issue. It was a shape. I did the new guy's bulls, and the very first one started hitting the ground at 80, 85, 90. And I'm almost freaking out. And he calls me up and he says, "How's it going?" I said, "Wow, these calves are big." He's like, "Well, what are you used to?" I said, 65, 70 pounders. And he's like, "Yeah." He says, "Have you touched any yet?" I said, "No." He says, "What's the problem?" I'm like, "Good point. What's the problem?" So birth weight, you know, that 1.7 birth weight is just a tick below average. I don't have a current set of Angus EPDs in front of me, but just running off memory, 1.7 is a tick below average birth weight. I think it's around a 2. So that means his calves are going to be slightly smaller than an average bull, or, you know, a bull with a 2.5 or a 3. pound birth weight. But the plus 3 calving ease direct means that they're probably not going to be super easy calvers. I mean, they're not going to be asleep all night, make every basketball game type of a deal. You could have some issues there on a few of those cattle.
Okay? So where do I go to know? How do I know that? Where do I go to find the numbers that tell me, you know, this is the breed average, and breed average cows will let you make every basketball game or right. will let you make 80% of the basketball games, whatever.
Sure.
Where do I go to know that?
You can Google it, angus.org, or any breed website will have, they'll post the current EPD averages for the breed. So it's available with a little bit of digging. Any kind of seed stock provider should provide that for you at any time. Just call them up and say, "Hey, what's the breed average? Where are your bulls? What are you looking at?" And that was one of my lists for going on down the line. Is one of the things that I think is so important with this is just the communication with your seed stock provider and having the trust that he's providing very accurate information and complete data on all these cattle that he's registering. Because unfortunately, there's a few people in the game that kind of try to skew the info and turn in some phony, might be a weird word, but kind of some phony data that doesn't make a lot of sense to try to make their bull maybe look a little bit better than the next guy's bull. And then if you're starting this project, you know, opening the seed stock catalog for the first time, you know, in my opinion, you're not buying the cattle, you're buying the service you get from your seed stock provider. And we all know that if he or she jeopardizes that relationship that you're trying to build by giving you bad information or misrepresenting his or her genetics, it's not going to be a very long-lived relationship, you know, because they're kind of fudging the numbers back and forth And you're going to find out pretty quick, boots on the ground, that, hey, this bull's a plus three cabinets direct. He ought to be like a minus five, because I had to pull 32% of these calves, and that is unacceptable. You know, so that's my deal, is you got to have a lot of faith and a lot of trust with the people that you're working with that are sourcing these cattle to begin with, that they're doing the right thing. And to build on that, you need to know exactly where they stand, because, you know, if you know their why do you raise seed stock? Well, I do this to provide an outstanding experience for my customers. You know, we want maintenance-free cattle that can cover a lot of bases, that are hopefully profitable for our customers, you know, then you're probably going to get along well with them. If their why is, yeah, I want to make $15 million and avoid taxes at all costs, maybe that isn't the guy that you want to be doing business with, and jeopardizing your attendance of basketball games and sleeping in late on a Saturday morning. So, yep.
So is there a rubric or of some kind where, you know, her breed average Cavanese direct is two, this yes. guy's three, that yep. means I'm going to touch this percentage. Is there some kind of a way to kind of put it down to a
no.
brass tacks level?
Nope. But, and I hear what you're saying here, so I'm going to try to answer that right now. So I think the first thing is we need to go back and evaluate is how did my calving season go this year? If we're talking about birth weight, you know, did I pull too many calves? Did I not touch any calves? Could I stand some more birth weight? Should we challenge the pelvis just a little bit with hopes of maybe having a little more production all where we're going? Or is where I'm at good enough for me? See what I'm saying? It's...
Yeah,
you got to make that decision as a producer and say, you know, needs improved, happy where it's at, or, you know, we could take on a little bit more of this and it wouldn't hurt anything. Because my experience in this whole evolution is there's no such thing as a perfect bovine. It's kind of like people. They're just kind of all over the place. What we try to do is just keep moving forward in the traits that we think is important for us. We put a fair amount of emphasis on the carcass traits, because we retain a lot of these cattle through the feed yard, and it's pretty real dollars and cents what they'll do when you got plenty of marbling, plenty of carcass weight, things like that. It can be pretty darn substantial, but there's a lot of time and energy go into that. So you want to be sure you're going to get paid before you start down that path. But anyhow, I think so. The first thing you have to do is create an accurate snapshot of where am I today? So we're going to start out, where am I right now? And I think for an average guy going into this, I would say, you know, if let's create the scenario, Clay, that, they threw you out of a parachute and you landed on a ranch and you got to run this ranch for 1 year and take good notes. And then you're going to go buy your first set of bulls. How does that sound? Okay.
Yep.
So if you've taken pretty decent records, which is, you know, here's how many calves we had to assist to get on the ground. Here's how many cows we got bred back. Here's our weaning weight. You know, here's our calf survivability. That would probably be just a very basic set of records that would probably be fairly useful. Then I think you could go from there to start building a set of EPDs that would boost your profitability on your ranch. And like I said, it's kind of interesting. So much energy has been to, the growth, the weaning weight and the yearling weight, but it appears to me that we've kind of hit the law of diminishing returns. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, everybody's weaning a 525 to 575 pound calf. And here we are with all this information, with the EPDs, with computers, with smartphones, and everybody's still weaning a 525 to 575 pound calf. So is it really, has that needle really moved very far? I don't know that it has personally. Now, what I believe has changed a lot is the days of feed that we can get these cattle to mature and go to harvest. I mean, back in the day, if you could get one to go at, you know, 20 months, 17 months, it was just pretty phenomenal. And now a lot of calf-fed calves are going 14 months, weighing 1,350 to 1,400 pounds, doing, you know, 25, 35% prime, 55, 65% certified Angus beef, just really doing well on the grid. So maybe that's one of the big gains that a lot of this data, a lot of this measuring has provided the industry, is just being able to get these cattle to finish faster.
Yeah. And yet if you're weaning, you know, or if you're selling off the cow, you're missing that. You're missing a lot of that.
Right.
You know,
I agree.
And so I think your bull selection needs to take that into account. And like you started out saying, you need to, you know, figure out what are we going to do, and then make bull selection based on those things, you know, because most people aren't retaining ownership.
Right.
So I think those are some really good things. You've mentioned some of the things that you look at. Could you kind of just give me a hierarchy of your favorite numbers to look at and sure, what they mean and where you start?
So, we got a lot of heifers. We like to look at the curve benders, because what we keep doing with the curve benders is we keep chipping away at this deal. We keep the moderate birth weight that'll work on a heifer or a cow. You know, there's still a lot of people out there like, well, you can't do anything with a heifer bull after 2 years because you don't want to put him out with cows, because you're going to, you know, why breed a cow to a heifer bull? But, you know, we buy bulls that are in the top 20% for calving ease, direct, and birth weight, but they're also in the top 20% for growth. And we can use them on a cow, we're good. We can use them on a heifer, we're good. And what we really do a lot of, Clay, is we do a lot of measuring. We look at these cattle, and they got to please us what they look like. And we let Mother Nature kind of have her way with all these yearling heifers. And she gets to put a sort on them and says, these females here are not cut out to be mothers, and they're open. So they go to the feedlot. But these girls here are the ones that Mother Nature says are going to make females. So we just trust her judgment, because she's always right every time. So anyhow, so we do a lot of measuring, and what we find is it's always a moving target, but if we're measuring, we can adjust our next step. So we'll look at this group of cattle and say, okay, I think this group of heifers on this, not only this ranch in Colorado, but we're fortunate, we can go look at the same genetics in Nebraska, we can look at the same genetics in Montana, Utah, Idaho, on, you know, six or eight ranches have very similar genetics. And we can say, you know what, these daughters are probably getting a little too much shin bone in them. We need to find something that's a little bit more moderate frame score. And we also think that these daughters probably could use a little bit more marbling, because we hang them up on the rail and we see how they perform that way. And we think that we're about spot on for weaning weight. Okay. And calving ease, we don't have any issues with calving ease. We're good to go either way. If the next bull has a tick more birth weight or calving ease direct goes down, hey, we can absorb that, because these females, it's already bred into them. So we measure where we're at, and then we make our decision on the next group and say, well, okay, carcass wise, we need more marbling. Growth wise, we probably need to go down a tick, because we think they're going to get too big to support in the Western United States. And calving ease, we can go either way. We just kind of widen our parameter a little bit, because it's not going to hurt us, because it's already there. So that's the big thing, is we just measure a lot of cattle and look at them really hard and then say, okay, well, here's the three areas that can stay the same. Here's the two areas that need to go down. And here's probably the two areas that need to go up. And then you can actually start sorting bulls based on that criteria. So that's kind of our program.
Gotcha.
And once again, our seed stock guy is a generation ahead of us. So let's say he has a whole bunch of females out of a bull called Joe. Then he breeds those to another bull called Louie. And if that's working, then we're all doing the same thing out here in the country because it works. If it doesn't work, he had the pain of going through that, and he will pull out the white flag and say, abandon ship, don't do this, whatever you do, but here's the other option that we think is going to work. But as far as the big numbers that we pay attention to are, of course, the birth weight, weaning weight, yearling weight. We try not to get completely carried away on yearling weight. We try to moderate that a bit because we feel like weaning weight has a lot to do with your cow and your environment. And, but the yearling weight, we focused for quite a while to bend the curve, high weaning weight with the lowest yearling weight available. So what this did was had some tremendously growthy calves with some super moderate females. So, I mean, they would explode to 1,000 pounds and shut down. And we had some 1,150, 1,200 pound mamas that were on the very front edge of the breed getting to that 1,000 or 1,100 pounds. But then they would quit because we bent the curve and said, instead of growing your whole life and turning into a 1,600 pound cow, which doesn't work for us, that doesn't mean she's bad. It just doesn't work in 16, 18 inches of rain, if you get it. But for us, we need them to be shutting down at that, you know, 11 and a half, 1250. So we could use the EPDs to put more emphasis on weaning and less emphasis on yearling. And that would help us keep plenty of growth and go to these calves where they could go to the feedlot and harvest them at 14 months. But then once they hit that 1,000 pounds or so, they were just pretty much done. And it took them another year, year and a half to get that next 150, 200 pounds. Hmm. We pay pretty good attention to milk. There's some serious debate about the milk EPD. Some people say it's pure pounds of milk that a cow produces. There's an alter opinion to that says part of it is pounds of milk she produces. Part of it is just survivability of her calf. So if your producer is turning in accurate records every year, and this girl has raised 9 calves in 9 attempts, and all these calves ratio better than average, she's going to have a higher milk number than just a cow that maybe has only raised 6 or 7 calves out of 9 years, and they didn't ratio as high. So some of the land grant universities are like, oh, you don't want a high milk cow because we don't have the resources to support her. It's just more feed. But there's also, depending on who you talk to, that say, well, part of that is true. Maybe 40% of that is the equation. But there's a couple more factors here. Is this cow has performed and she has raised a calf. Her survivability of that calf goes into her pounds of milk. So I've asked some people that really should know the answer to that, and they kind of give me the, well, you know, so the jury's still out on that a little bit. We're probably not as scared of the milk deal as some other people are. But once again, we don't really go to any extremes. We're just kind of either side of breed average. And obviously we look at the females, and if they have adequate milk, a calf will get up, nurse, be healthy and grow. Definitely if you took a Holstein type cow and turned her out on the range, she'd starve to death and her calf would die and it wouldn't work because she's focused too much on milk. So that's kind of where we look at the milk deal. Carcass weight you know, our goal is to feed every animal that comes off this ranch. We're either going to feed them or breed them. So carcass weight is important. Once again, we talked about the weaning weight and the yearling weight, how we tried to bend that curve. Well, you know, one of the easiest ways to increase your carcass weight is to have a sire and a dam that are, you know, 1800 pound cow and a 2700 pound bull. Well, yeah, you're going to have some big carcasses, but can we bend that curve once again to where we have a very moderate cow with a high carcass weight EPD? Well, yes, we can. And we've done it. And it's pretty interesting. Marbling is how you get paid for your quality grades. Marbling is a very, very easy thing to increase in a cow. It's super heritable. It's one of the most heritable traits in this whole list. And basically, it's just, is this animal predisposed to building intramuscular fat? And from the research I've read, it actually happens a lot of it in the embryonic stage. So if your cow is in good rig and good nutrition, doing her thing right, well, that calf is an embryo, and you got the genetic capability to marble, it's somebody's going to get paid for it on down the road. Because I haven't looked in the last couple of weeks, but the last time I looked, a prime number three animal was worth $20 over a choice yield grade three. So $20 on a 900 to 1,000 pound carcass is 180 to 200 bucks a head. And all you had to do is select for it. You didn't have to, most of the time, you don't have to pay more for marbling. You just got to keep your eye on it and select for it. So,
you've used the term curve bender a couple of times here. And I told my wife I'd be home at a certain time today. And so I'm going to keep that promise. So we're kind of moving towards wrapping up, but there's definitely more here, obviously. But you've used the term a couple of times of curve bender. Is that kind of bending that curve of terminal and maternal towards each other so that the same animal can be both? Yep. Or is that a good way to think about it?
I think that's a very accurate description. You know, I think if you take generic bull of breed one and generic bull of breed two, you can easily capture a lot of heterosis. You can get a lot of advantage through hybrid vigor. I think the same thing can be done within a breed and any breed, that if you focus on what you want, what your ultimate goal is of, let's just say, a low birth weight, high weaning weight, moderate yearling weight, high carcass weight, abundant marbling cattle that do a lot of things right, you can build it within a breed if you want to, if you elect to do that, because we have the information, we have the data, we have the technology, we have the ability to use these EPDs, direct these cattle in about any direction we want to go. If we wanted to build low lines, we could use EPDs to build a new set of low lines. If we wanted to build the high lines, which would be a bunch of 2,700 pound cattle, we could do that too. I think the big deal is just A, figuring out where you're at, B, figuring out where you want to go. And then if you can relay that to a seed stock provider, he would love to have somebody come up and say, look, here's where I'm at on calving. Here's where I'm at on weaning and yearling. I want to market these calves at this point in time. I want to get paid for it. And the ultimate goal is this. I think almost any seed stock producer I know would love to just sit down and say, hey, that's great. Go use bull number three's progeny. And when you get them on the ground, give me a call and we'll figure out where to breed those back, because we have the technology. You know, that's what this whole deal is about, is just trying to help you in the direction that you decide you want to move towards. For us, we are not going to chase any one trait. We are going to take a balanced approach because, you know, it's the, A, it's the law of diminishing returns, and B, every action causes an equal and opposite reaction, and you shoot yourself in the foot over here to chase this other side. Well, let's just incrementally keep moving forward, you know. Like ribeye, our cattle are very average ribeye, but we have enough data back that says we don't need to increase the ribeye because we're not going to get paid for it. Ribeye often has a little bit to do with the size of the animal to begin with, which could go back to the yearling weight, which could go back to bigger females. We're very content where we're at with ribeye. And I tell that to people and they're like, no, you need more ribeye. And I'm like, no, we don't. I've visited with the buyers. I've visited with the packers. They're tickled where our ribeye is. They do not want bigger ribeyes because the end user cannot use a 19-inch ribeye. It is too big. They like the smaller ribeyes that they can cut thicker. They like consistent. They like uniform product. They want to open a 50-pound box of ribeyes and have them all the exact same size. But there's, you know, so that's one thing that we measure, that we're good. If it goes up a tick or down a tick, it doesn't matter. It's not going to affect our bottom line. So we're not going to chase it. We're not going to go after it because we're not really getting paid for any more ribeye. So it's, you know, 10 years ago, I'd have said, oh, we need all the ribeye we can get, but it turns out we don't. So that's kind of interesting.
Kind of final question, I guess. And if I need to include this in the show notes page with, you know, if you need to email me later, that's fine. Sure. But workingcows.net/206 will be the show notes page for today. Where would you send people to learn more? I think very helpful stuff you've said so far is kind of figure out where you're at and where you want to go as far as when you're going to market and how you're going to market, and then go talk to your seed stock producer. Is that the best place? Or, I mean, make sure your seed stock producer is a guy you can trust and is honest, like you said. But are there resources you would recommend people learn from, or is it a conversation with a seed stock producer is going to be the most helpful?
I personally think the best thing you can do is find somebody that's doing what you want to do or very similar to what you want to do and go talk to them. Because, you know, a smart guy learns from his mistakes, but a wise man learns from everybody else's. And you find the guy that's doing pretty close to what you think you want to do, and he's going to know what breed you may want to use, where to get those cattle. He's going to give you three places to never buy them. You know, he's going to know what kind of works and what can put you down this path. You know, your breed associations have field men. They will be happy to visit with you about your needs. Most of these breed associations have marketing men too. I mean, the Red Angus Yellow Tag deal, Simmentals have a great program. Of course, there's Angus Link. All these people are there to help you. And if they don't know who to talk to, they will sure find you a name and a number of somebody that can help you down this path. But yeah, and I think the thing is to talk to a lot of people. You know, if you have questions, just start asking, because my experience in this business is if you ask somebody a question, hey, you're going to have three more questions before you're done, but you're going to have a list of five people that will try to give you a very clear answer that'll help you progress on down the road. So just get going on that and don't be bashful. Just do it.
Very good. Ryan, appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You bet, Clay. It's like I said before, it's a great program and we enjoy it. And thank you for all your efforts. And congratulations on 200 plus. I'll call you back when we get to 1,000.
We might have to go daily to get there. I don't know. Very good stuff there with Ryan. Really appreciate his perspective and his willingness to share that perspective and how he makes it not necessarily dogmatic, but something that people can kind of inform with their own decisions and look at from a different perspective and look at with a little bit more of a critical eye towards their own businesses rather than saying this is a blanket statement for how you should organize your business. Very good. Very, very helpful. Really appreciate that. As of right now, not exactly sure what episode 207 will hold, but Lord willing, we will see you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.